Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Talk about creative women, you're about to meet one. Juliana Forlano, satirist, professor, and licensed psychotherapist, is the writer, host, producer of the award-winning political news parody Absurdity Today. It can be found on DirecTV and Dish Network's FSTV. There's the Young Turks Online Network, Free Speech TV, and the Progressive Voices Radio Network. Juliana also produces the Laughing Liberally Lab, a live political humor showcase in New York City. She's appeared at the Democratic National Convention, Barack Obama's inaugural ball, HuffPost Live, and the Randy Rhodes Show. She's been a contributor to MichaelMoore.com, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the book Letters to President Obama. Juliana's also an adjunct professor, teaching media ethics, broadcast journalism, writing for new media, and comedy script writing at Brooklyn College. Oh, wait, and let's not forget therapy. Juliana's been a behavioral psychotherapist and life coach for more than 10 years. Juliana, welcome.
I'm here.
Indulge me by letting me go straight for the obvious.
Okay.
You're a psychotherapist? Explain the connection between that line of work and being a political satirist. And how did one spawn the other?
Well, that's interesting. I think I love the title of your show, first of all, and thank you for having me on. I got a master's degree while I was doing comedy on the side. And I really do think the two things are related, because I think as I was learning about language and the effect of language, mm-hmm. and, you know, everybody who works in marketing knows about messaging, and everyone who works in in politics knows about messaging and getting the message to sound just so it has this certain effect. I think both psychotherapy and humor, especially political humor, are basically almost the same. It's basically being able to.
Well,
sort
who's
of...
more nuts?
Oh, yeah. Good question. Good question. Yeah.
I think to myself, if I was your client,
I started laughing at them a lot. They didn't like that much.
I wonder if you mine your sessions.
I feel that the healing relationship in psychotherapy is one of sort of mentorship, and not like I'm this blank slate and you're not going to get anything from me. Mm-hmm. So I feel that there needs to be more of a connection between the two individuals. And that's sort of how I work. I do groups and I work one-on-one with people. But those people have also come over to my house at Christmas. You know,
see you in another role.
Yes. You know that therapists, I'm going to get in trouble.
But go for it.
Some psychotherapists are kind of nuts, right?
You'd have to be.
Right? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the rumor on the street health department. Mm-hmm. I feel like if you actually, you can't just tell someone, oh, here, if you do this, it'll change your behavior. You have to be a role model. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they can say, well, you had this issue, and therefore, you tried this, and it worked for you. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I work.
I can't imagine, I'm not talking specifically to you, that you're listening to somebody kind of drone on.
No, we never do that in cognitive behavioral.
No? Yeah. And you're not thinking to yourself, oh, gosh, get over it.
I'm socking it already. I'd hate someone to say that to me, because I'm sure I've gone on and on and on with my, you know,
Mishagas.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Both of these careers work in tandem is basically what you're saying to
definitely.
Me. But you feel more comfortable in one versus
another?
Well, you
another? Know, I just feel like it was a process of unfolding, mm-hmm. you know, and because I had such deep relationships with the people I was already working with when I moved over to start doing comedy, I just maintained them. They think it's valuable. I can offer whatever I'm offering to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's fine.
So were you always funny?
Probably.
Why aren't you sure about that?
I mean, I don't know. It's not like comics. Do comics just say, like, I am hilarious at all times? I guess maybe they do, especially the men.
Well, that's a whole other story.
It's funny because I teach comedy writing at Brooklyn College, right? And I asked the students why they took the class. And most of the men said, because I think I'm funny and I know I'm funny and I want to get this A and I want to meet some people and make my, you know, debut, write my first screenplay.
And then when you don't give them an A, what happens?
Well, I don't know. But the women don't say that about themselves.
Right.
They say, well, I might try, you know.
And it's still 2014 and they're saying that.
Yeah. It's really quite sad. I point it out to the class. I point out. But this year we have, there's 25 students in the class.
Mm-hmm.
About 16 of them are women. And
wonderful.
Before it was one.
Wow.
And all men. So it has, you know, I just like saying, hey, as a female comedian and professor, again, I'm doing that thing where I am a comedian. This is how I do it. You don't have to necessarily do it this way. This is what the academia says on how to write a screenplay. I'll tell you, I'll show you, I'll give you my guidance. But I'm not telling them something I don't personally already experience.
Well, you know, you made me think of something when you said the number of females in the class. So there are more women in the class, but there are very few female comedy writers. Why is that?
That is an excellent question. And I don't know if my answer is going to be...
Well, I'm like not going to grade you.
Yeah. I don't know if it's going to be the answer, but my perception is a couple of things. Generally, people don't start out and say, oh, I'm going to be a comedy writer. They get into it in some way or another, and then they go in that direction. Mm-hmm. I know for myself with stand-up, it's mostly guys. And if it is women, sometimes the women have to play the guys' game.
Yes.
Instead of having their point of view and putting it out there. Women aren't socialized to have their point of view and put it out there mm-hmm. in most of American culture. I'm mm-hmm. sorry to say. I can't speak for every ethnicity, obviously.
Next time.
Next time. I'll come
back. You'll go back and study this and you'll come.
I'll come back with a whole full-on study. Doing stand-up is a very, it's sort of a masculine activity, I think. You know, where you are in control of, if you're good, you know, you're in control of that audience. It's sort of like conducting. I always felt like it was like conducting, you know, an orchestra mm-hmm. where you're bringing them up and bringing them back down. And you know when to do it and you go faster and slower and mm-hmm. it's this whole thing. And then at the end, you know, there's a beautiful, there's a whole piece. You've had a whole piece. And you really have to control the audience.
Uh-huh.
You have to have a really thick skin because people are murderously horrendous to you. They're just...
Well, you're on the stage naked for all intents and
basically,
purposes.
Basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, more naked than if I was naked. Mm-hmm. If I was naked, it would be funny and we would make jokes.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But, like, naked with just myself and...
It's terrifying.
My creative self. And it's not... You know, I've heard other comics talk about this before. In other art forms, you don't really take that art... put it in front of an audience that they somehow feel like it's their job to yell at how much it's great or sucks right at the artist.
When they're looking at a painting.
Exactly.
Or, yes.
A painting, a poem. Mm-hmm. You don't have people showing up at the comedy club saying, well, or at the poetry night saying, I had a good friend who did comedy that talked about exactly this, saying there better be onomatopoeia tonight or I'm going to be mad. I am going
to. If this poem has no alliteration, I'm demanding my money back.
I am
going
to throw something at the thing or tell her, hey, tell us a joke or ask her to suck something.
But there is a difference, is there not, between being a comic and being a political satirist?
I should hope so.
And so that would lead into the fact that maybe political satire is an area, a genre, that women feel more comfortable in?
I wonder. Are there other ones? I mean, there's Liz Winstead and there's me. So I'm part of this whole sort of underground comedic. We're not going to wait for NBC to find us, although we're all kind of waiting. You know, we're all hoping. But we're going to make our own thing in our own voice. And that's something that the internet allows. And you can be really political and you can find your audience. I mean, when I was playing at Caroline's or when I was playing at some of the bigger clubs, even the clubs outside of the city, you have to entertain everybody in there. You really do, because they paid for it. And if you don't...
So you're not speaking to one person.
No, I mean, how can you... And in this political landscape where this one hates that one and these hate that and this and the gays...
Yeah, but you'll never
that,
run out of material in this political landscape.
That's true, but you can't perform in front of just a general audience, I think, in this political landscape. And not the kind of things that me and my co... comedians at Laughing Liberally are doing. I know some comics who do the like, well, Republicans are this way and Democrats are that way, but I don't do that. I say, hey, this is my opinion. And sometimes, you know, a friend of mine told me once, if you're doing something right, half the people will hate you for it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the comedy club, you have to entertain all of the people all of the time. Otherwise, you don't get booked back.
Yes, but on the other hand, everything that comes out of your mouth or anybody else's mouth is not funny all the time.
That's true.
And you would like to think that people are discriminating. That, yeah, that was funny, but that wasn't so funny. It doesn't matter. As long as you've made some connection, I would think.
But I don't know. I think when you're trying to get booked at the clubs and then... it seems to me like you need, there's like this ratio that I was told, I remember being a new comic. You have to make them laugh once every 15 seconds. And if you're not doing that, four laughs a minute,
Really?
That's what I was told. I don't think it's necessarily true.
I can't imagine comedy's that formulaic either.
But it certainly seems like, you know, they're expecting you to keep it at a maximum pace of laughter in order to keep the audience happy. And the audiences are changing. It's not like people are like, oh, let's go see what's cutting edge mm-hmm. in comedy at, you know, Giggle Yucks on the 40s on the freeway, you know.
But then what a wonderful opportunity that the internet provides you, that
exactly.
you can do whatever you want. And
right.
so that moves us very nicely into absurdity today.
Yeah.
So how was that started and why was that started?
You know, I took a comedy writing class in Chicago from one of the former writers from Saturday Night Live. And I had already been doing like improv and some stand up, but I took, you know, I wanted to know the formulas. You know, mm-hmm. and as it turns out, I was good at it. You know, I learned about being good at it by trying it. And then, you know, I'm sure I'm not good at everything.
So you took it.
Yeah, so I took this class and I thought, well, let's get to it. And I remember the guy who taught the class, Michael McCarthy, he's still in Chicago. He said, don't just go in there and try to fit in. Go in there and take over. He said that. Mm-hmm. And it stuck with me. I mean, the writing class was great, but what he offered to the students was really encouragement and sort of a mindset of how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a, I don't know, a type A personality, I guess you would say, or like a pusher, a mover forward. Let's mm-hmm. go. I can't wait around doing, you know, 20-minute sets here and there. I have to be doing something else in addition to that. Right. So,
So that felt like a comfortable shoe for you to launch that show?
Yeah, it was on radio at first. It was on Chicago Public Radio and National Public Radio. We're doing this outreach project called Vocalo in Chicago, where they were trying
When
to,
was this?
This was, I guess, I don't know, maybe 2005.
Okay.
Just don't quote me on the number, but
context. Okay.
They were doing this outreach where they were trying to, you know, reach out beyond the normal NPR audience, get sort of younger people, get sort of, you know, hipper people. I don't know if I would consider myself a hip individual, but they did. So mm-hmm. that was fine. Mm-hmm. And I started making this 2-minute series. You know, it was sort of Saturday Night Live's weekend update for politics.
And from your perspective.
And from my perspective. The writing of it was natural, but the performance of it built over time. I keep hearing, oh, this is even better. Every time I put one out, I'm like, I hear like, wow, this is great. And oh, I love this even more than the last one. And I think to myself, was I that horrible at the beginning? And maybe I was. But, you know, I try not to.
Maybe you were stiffer because what I have seen, it just seems very natural to me.
Yeah. I think I was trying to sort of do what they do on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update.
Mm-hmm.
And now
without
I'm just
having
doing...
kind of carved out your own
yeah,
niche.
Right. And now I'm just doing me.
So is this one a week, one a day?
I wish it was one a day. We need, you know, the funding and the support for one a day. But it's one a week about,
and
sometimes less.
And who's involved in Absurdity Today?
I am the main person involved in Absurdity Today. I do the editing. I do most of the writing. We have some other writers. They contribute. We have some writers who will, say, contribute 20 pieces of writing and only one will get in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have other writers who are also some of the Laughing Liberally comics who will contribute. They'll contribute 10 jokes and 8 will make it in,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is a humongous ratio. That's amazing.
But you're the only performer.
I'm the only performer.
So what's Laughing Liberally?
Oh, Laughing Liberally. It's, well, there's a group called Living Liberally. It's a social/political organization that was founded so that liberals in places where there aren't tons of liberals can get together and do things with like-minded individuals. It's not that sort of important or to people's social lives here in New York where there's a lot of liberals, hopefully still.
I think
so. You know, you go to Idaho, you go to Nevada, you go to
North Dakota.
Yeah, any of these places, they're like secret liberals.
Sure. You're looking for a Lanceman, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's, you know, this group, the umbrella group is called Living Liberally, mm-hmm. and there's Drinking Liberally. So people mm-hmm. get together at a bar whatever city they're in on Thursdays or Wednesday or whatever day. And they get together and they chat about politics. Or, you know, there's Brunching Liberally or Reading Liberally, book groups all over the place. And we are Laughing Liberally.
You started that segment.
I did not start it, but I am the current producer of it. It was started by some other comedians who are currently on the docket.
And this is all around the country?
It's all around the country.
And you actually do this in Manhattan?
Yes, I produce the show that's in Manhattan, and I perform in it also, along with other comics like John Fugelsang, who he had a show on Current TV. Scott Blakeman, Dean Obadala is a writer for The Daily Beast. Katie Halpern, she's a writer for Feminist Thing and a comic. These people are writers and comics. And Nagin Farsad, she's a comic and a very funny woman who just produced a documentary called The Muslims Are Coming, where she took a bunch of Muslim comics and went to these southern states and made a documentary about it. So there's all this, there is this sort of the heartbeat of the sort of political comedy movement.
And how often is the lab up and running?
It's twice a month. So it's the second and fourth Friday. So if you got five.
At a club?
Yes. Jimmy's 43. It is a cabaret space.
So how many people in a given Friday night would perform?
About eight. Some performers have longer sets, some shorter. And we rotate. We rotate around.
So you're not performing every time the
lab... I am performing almost every time I'm the producer.
Okay. Because you can.
Well, because I have to be there anyway as the producer. So... it does help, too.
And is it just stream of consciousness?
No. People have sets.
You know what you're saying before you're up there.
Yep.
Is most of your humor exclusively political?
Or
do you personalize it?
I definitely personalize. I think that's, they say the personal is the political.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important because I think just talking heads, talking about talking heads doesn't have any impact on people.
Mm-hmm.
But if I bring it home.
Bring it home for me. Give me an example. Mm.
Well, I'm currently talking about gentrification, and I'm talking about, I call it the Gentrification Chronicles. And the funny part I have moved to Queens from Brooklyn, and I talk
Brooklyn
about...
is the center of the universe for people who may not know.
Right.
Well, many people feel that way,
and
I
it's
say.
Completely gentrifying.
Exactly. And Spike Lee just did a piece about this. Yes, and how angry he is about gentrification. His wasn't funny. He's just pissed.
It's really sad. My landlord raised our rent by $500 a month.
In Brooklyn.
Yeah, and we moved out when he said he was going to do that. And then he raised it $800 for the next guy. It's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
And plus, it's kind of like, I didn't want to live there anymore anyway. When they say something's up and coming, that's still cool. But this one's up and came. And now it's trampled
by the
sons and daughters of the wealthy.
That's exactly
and those
right.
Folks might be friendly and lovely, but they're I don't know. The whole thing just becomes devoid of culture. I mean, gentrification just happens over and over. And like I say in my act, you think, oh, a bunch of fine gents are moving into your neighborhood. And won't this be great for everyone? And, it's not that. It just changes the entire culture. And it happens in the blink of an eye.
So you were the opening act for Susie Essman.
Sure.
From Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes,
what was that like?
Great.
How does that work? Does she pick you? Do you pick her?
I would love to pick her. I think she kind of picked me. I mean, we met at in Chicago. She was performing in Chicago, and
that's sort of the center of the universe for comics because of Second City.
Yes, definitely, and it's sort of a lower stress kind of a place. It's not L.A. It's not New York. Beginning comics can get a whole bunch of education and stage time. There are audiences. People are interesting. It has a cosmopolitan feel to it, and the airport can get you anywhere.
That's for sure.
In the middle of everywhere.
So that's your paths crossed there?
Our paths crossed there, and the owner of the club really, he made me a house MC, which is an amazing job for a beginning comic, because you get...
That's stepping in it?
You get, yeah, definitely. You get to work every single day of the week in front of a great audience for, a month, and then you go work at another club for a month. So stage time is what's so important because with comedy, you have to practice your act in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
It would be so much better if I could just go home and learn my lines and recite them.
That would be
so much easier.
But as the MC and you're introducing the other comics, are you allowed?
Yeah, you have to.
You can do your own
Absolutely.
Thing.
You have to do, you're the warm-up act. You're the one who gets them when they're cold. And you give the announcements. The bathrooms are over here. Tonight we have this. And then you start talking with them and you do your act for 10, 15 minutes in the beginning.
And then they're always seeing you for the rest of the evening because you're back introducing somebody else. That is pretty wonderful.
And I got to meet a lot of great comics. And the best part was that I got to watch comics do their act over and over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
So to see a comic do their act once is entertaining. To watch them do it every day, Tuesday through Friday, with two shows on Friday, three on Saturday, and one on Sunday. You're seeing the art. You're seeing, you know, how it turns, the tricks they're using, the things that seem like they're just talking to you when they're so precisely defined. And
so that's on the job training, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's really great. I got to see a lot of great comics, especially the female comics that came through. I would watch every set.
Mm-hmm.
Every set.
How did you wind up at the inauguration?
Oh, so I was doing, it was his inaugural ball in Chicago. I was doing stand up, and I was doing that show for the Chicago Public Radio program. And you know, you'd meet people because you're in and out, and you know. And I, how did I meet? I'm trying to remember, I met the guy who was booking the acts
for
yeah
Barack Obama's party
yes.
in Chicago,
right?
And he,
which
said,
was a big deal because his, you know, he's from Chicago.
Duh,
this is like
yeah.
his home deal.
Uh huh.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And so you did what? You were one of several comics?
No, I was the comic.
Get Out.
No, I know Get Out. Exactly. I was like, wow, I've struck it rich.
Wait a second. This inaugural, is it called a ball? It
yeah.
was a ball in
mm-hmm.
Chicago. And they had, you know, they were singers
yeah.
and
yep.
whatever.
A lot of singers.
But you were the sole comic.
I was the sole comic. Yeah.
Wow. Is that one of the premier moments
so
in your professional
nervous.
Career?
Well, at the I thought it was going to be. But it's funny, comedy requires a certain setup. It's not that easy to be funny in a, you know, if it's not set up properly. And this one had like a dance floor between the stage and where the audience was. So I took the mic off the stand. Thank God it was a wireless. And I just walked into the audience and started doing the act from the floor.
That was brilliant.
So I just did it, and it was really great, and it was really fun. And I have video of it. I just haven't.
And how long were you performing?
I think 40 minutes.
40 minutes?
Yeah.
And you were funny for 40 minutes?
I think so.
Isn't that
they
terrific?
Paid me.
And did that, was that kind of a seminal moment in your career? Did that open a lot of doors
no.
for you? Why?
Because these are political people that I was performing for. It wasn't like I was on The Tonight Show where industry was there.
So if I was your fairy godmother, what is it you would want from me in terms of your performing? Or do you have everything
oh,
that you want?
I would want you to expand absurdity today to be, you know, to have a more expanded audience, like the kind of audience you get on a network instead of on the internet.
Can this not be translated to the small screen?
Sure, it can. Yeah, absolutely. It is already on one channel.
You mean DirecTV?
My segment is 2 to 4 minutes, right? So it's absurdity today. It is 2 to 4 minute segment. It's fast paced. It's made for the internet and for interstitial use on radio
mm-hmm.
and for playing, like people play it during their show. They'll like,
right.
you know, they'll say, here's Giuliano Villano. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Julia. And then there's the,
your piece.
Yeah. My piece. So it hasn't been sort of expanded out to that half an hour block or that hour block. But if you're my fairy godmother, that's what we're going to do.
Do you think that will happen?
I do. Yeah, I do. Cause it's gaining momentum and popularity.
And
I am the only one. I'm the only game in town.
Who does this?
Yeah, who does this. Because it also requires, I mean, I edit it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to know how to edit in a way that's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, I guess I didn't know this, but there are certain people who can do one thing and certain people who can do one other thing.
But you
well.
Cross the line.
But I cross those lines and I'm able to sort of pick up and do.
So you're a package deal.
I'm a package deal.
Which in and of itself is a good thing.
I hope. I think so.
So are you still, you're still performing live?
Mm-hmm.
And how often do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And do you tour a lot? Are you around the
I've
country?
I've stopped touring. We're talking about touring with the Laughing Liberally. So that's a potential. But I kind of stopped doing the road dog work because, you know, producing the show takes a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to, you know, make a call. Do I want to be on the road constantly knocking down doors, you know, going to the, like I said, it's just a choice. You know, there's nothing wrong with doing that. I know comics who are happy doing it or who do it. And
when I was saying to you in terms of not running out of material, for example, right now, the governor of Arizona, for example,
Jan Brewer
is either going to or not going to sign legislation that will allow store owners the option of not serving someone if they're gay. That would certainly be food for your fodder, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. She's appeared in Absurdity Today in the past. Remember they had that enormous dust storm that came over Phoenix, or it came over Arizona? It was like this huge cloud of dust. And they were like, you know, my joke was that, you know, that the weather people were still trying to figure out what caused it. But I'm pretty sure it was Jan Brewer finally blew the dust off her copy of the Constitution. And it just like, you know, the woman, what happened to constitutionality? They can't vote that you.
It's stunning, isn't it?
It is so absurd now. The things that are happening are so absurd. The Jan Brewer story is absurd.
Exactly.
So I don't have to do much other than list it, you know?
Right.
I'm like an aggregator.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Sometimes I'm like, do you guys know why this is ridiculous? Because I assume it's ridiculous, and then I don't realize that other people haven't maybe been following the issue that closely.
So what's tomorrow going to bring for you, do you think?
Actual tomorrow?
No.
Oh.
Is there something that you want to do besides having Absurdity Today make it on network? What would you like to do?
I think my best qualities, because so we put together being knowledgeable about the politics,
mm-hmm.
being humorous, and being a psychotherapist, right? So understanding sort of the currents of how.
What a trinity that is.
I think I would make an excellent host of a show, like I like doing what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
because I like engaging people in conversation.
Because people have a lot of interesting things to say. That's certainly what I found.
Yeah.
And when given the opportunity, which doesn't necessarily.
But some people don't have interesting things to say.
And they're the ones who are interviewed ad nauseum. That's the thing that stuns me.
That's so true.
You know, what more am I going to learn from Martha Stewart or Beyonce or whatever? And everybody's so well prepped for that you can't sort of chip that away.
Yeah. Actually, I was just reading in New York Magazine the piece that Alec Baldwin wrote. Have you read it? And he was talking about how he went on MSNBC and wanted to do exactly that, bring on interesting people. He wanted to bring Deborah Winger on. And the producers were like, why? They didn't see any, if it wasn't sort of this celebrity culture thing.
Right.
They didn't see any reason. I think people, it's really saddening to me to think that people are kind of forgetting about the valuable parts of humanity and the value of being alive.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, let me just chase down Beyonce. Oh, look, I got a picture of her nose. What does that have any meaning to you? Does it make you better in any way? No. But like reading some, you know, getting some like talking to some great creative person mm-hmm. or actor or actress. I don't have to tell you. You have this whole show
mm-hmm.
and I think it's amazing.
And trust me that the list is endless.
I'm so glad.
The list is endless.
Yeah.
And that's what's been so exciting. And we've kind of run out of time, but you only add to that. Juliana, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure. And thank you so much for doing this show, especially Women's and Creative Voices.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That means a lot to me. And I mean it. It really does. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.